Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C1. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Example.
In the unpopular political drive to raise the retirement age in France, Emmanuel Macron should remind his countrymen that Georges Clemenceau took over as France's leader in 1917 at the age of 76 and led it to victory in the First World War in 1918. Article Macron's Retirement Gamble, January 14th.
1.
You think that Poland is wrong to keep pressing Germany on restitution for Nazi crimes during the Second World War. Article Frenemies on the Oder, January 7th. Poland has received only derisory compensation for the millions of deaths, expulsions, colonization, slave labor, and destruction of a large chunk of its physical assets during the war. The vast tracts of land that Germany has ceded to Poland cannot compare to Poland's loss of half its terrain after 1939, including the then-majority Polish cities of Wilno, or Vilnius, and Lwów, or Lviv. This loss was caused by Germany's war. The contrast with Germany's decent treatment of Israel is glaring.
2.
I was appalled by your leader on Turkey's looming dictatorship, January 21st. Labelling the prospect of re-election of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who's been elected many times through a free and popular vote, as a dictatorship, is utterly wrong and unfair. I would like to remind you that Turkey has a vibrant democracy with a clean record in its electoral system. Such biased claims about the democratically elected president of the country ignore the stainless electoral history of Turkey.
3.
The gutting of schools' physical education requirements is cited as one reason behind America's obesity problem. Article Marching on Their Stomachs, January 14th. However, school PE programs often serve unfit students very poorly. They are designed by the fit, for the fit, and make little attempt to be rewarding and halfway pleasant for the less fit. They emphasize competition between students with little allowance for differing levels of ability. Seriously unfit children find them painful and humiliating rather than helpful.
4.
The phantom country, created by the Centre for European Reform to track Britain's post-Brexit economic performance, is invalid. Article, careful assembly required, January 7th. Macroeconomic theory tells us that the only economy that behaves like Britain is one that has the same consumers, firms, institutions, policies and shocks. Namely, only Britain itself. A method that is valid is to interrogate Britain's own relationships for evidence that they shifted because of Brexit. I have done this in a recent working paper with a colleague. Meanwhile, a long list of other shocks, including lockdowns and commodity impacts because of COVID and the Ukraine war, have caused us substantial damage. It is unworthy of The Economist to join in the sloppy Remainer thinking that blames our troubles on Brexit.
5.
When Money Dies, article December 24th, focused on the lessons from inflation of the 1500s. One further contemporary parallel emerging from the 16th century Scottish context is the uneven impact of inflation across the population. Even in the 16th century, inflation for essential goods outstripped that for luxury items, and wages lagged behind price rises. Accordingly, it was the poor who suffered most, and the rich who were cushioned by the relatively smaller portions of their budgets devoted to essential items.
6.
I enjoyed your article on Prince Harry's autobiography, article Spare Us, January 14th. It reminded me of elite overproduction, an idea put forward by Peter Turchin, a complexity scientist in which a society produces more members of the elite than the elite can absorb. This, Mr. Turchin thinks, can lead to social instability because those left out of power feel dissatisfied with their lower socio-economic status. The royal family provides us with perfect examples of this. Those left out of power are causing a great deal of instability at Buckingham Palace.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Example.
In the unpopular political drive to raise the retirement age in France, Emmanuel Macron should remind his countrymen that Georges Clemenceau took over as France's leader in 1917 at the age of 76 and led it to victory in the First World War in 1918. Article, Macron's retirement gamble, January 14th.
1.
You think that Poland is wrong to keep pressing Germany on restitution for Nazi crimes during the Second World War. Article, Frenemies on the Oder, January 7th. Poland has received only derisory compensation for the millions of deaths, expulsions, colonization, slave labor, and destruction of a large chunk of its physical assets during the war. The vast tracts of land that Germany has ceded to Poland cannot compare to Poland's loss of half its terrain after 1939, including the then majority Polish cities of Wilno, or Vilnius, and Lwów, or Lviv. This loss was caused by Germany's war. The contrast with Germany's decent treatment of Israel is glaring.
2.
I was appalled by your leader on Turkey's looming dictatorship, January 21st. Labelling the prospect of re-election of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who's been elected many times through a free and popular vote, as a dictatorship is utterly wrong and unfair. I would like to remind you that Turkey has a vibrant democracy with a clean record in its electoral system. Such biased claims about the democratically elected president of the country ignore the stainless electoral history of Turkey.
3.
The gutting of schools' physical education requirements is cited as one reason behind America's obesity problem. Article, Marching on Their Stomachs, January 14th. However, school PE programs often serve unfit students very poorly. They are designed by the fit, for the fit, and make little attempt to be rewarding and halfway pleasant for the less fit. They emphasize competition between students with little allowance for differing levels of ability. Seriously unfit children find them painful and humiliating rather than helpful.
4.
The phantom country, created by the Centre for European Reform to track Britain's post-Brexit economic performance, is invalid. Article, Careful Assembly Required, January 7th. Macroeconomic theory tells us that the only economy that behaves like Britain is one that has the same consumers, firms, institutions, policies and shocks. Namely, only Britain itself. A method that is valid is to interrogate Britain's own relationships for evidence that they shifted because of Brexit. I have done this in a recent working paper with a colleague. Meanwhile, a long list of other shocks, including lockdowns and commodity impacts because of COVID and the Ukraine war, have caused us substantial damage. It is unworthy of The Economist to join in the sloppy Remainer thinking that blames our troubles on Brexit.
5.
When Money Dies, article December 24th, focused on the lessons from inflation of the 1500s. One further contemporary parallel emerging from the 16th century Scottish context is the uneven impact of inflation across the population. Even in the 16th century, inflation for essential goods outstripped that for luxury items, and wages lagged behind price rises. Accordingly, it was the poor who suffered most and the rich who were cushioned by the relatively smaller portions of their budgets devoted to essential items.
6.
I enjoyed your article on Prince Harry's autobiography, article Spare Us, January 14th. It reminded me of elite overproduction, an idea put forward by Peter Turchin, a complexity scientist in which a society produces more members of the elite than the elite can absorb. This, Mr. Turchin thinks, can lead to social instability because those left out of power feel dissatisfied with their lower socioeconomic status. The royal family provides us with perfect examples of this. Those left out of power are causing a great deal of instability at Buckingham Palace.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
I have an entire operation around shopping. I take it very, very seriously.
And I've got loads of items that I just never even wear. Beautiful, beautiful quality. I've had it for over a year. It hasn't even been taken off the hanger.
Extract 1.
When we look around the high street and stores, we see lots and lots of stuff. But the most interesting thing about consumption and buying is what's going on in our minds. The story of stuff begins in our imagination and in our fantasies. That's the space where we dream about all the things that we would really, really love to have and what a wonderful life we would have if only we could have this stuff.
I always think, yeah, this is it, this is the item. This is what's going to make me happy.
What we consume is an expression of our identity because our identity consists of a number of different facets. We have an actual self, who we actually are most of the time, but then we also have a social self. We buy products, clothes that express who we want to be at any point in time.
I have two moods, so, and they're both as vital to me as the other. Like, I feel like sometimes clothes help me take on a character.
Extract 2.
Buying something new makes me feel excited and, like, full of adrenaline.
Marketers are very, very good at speaking to the parasympathetic nervous system, the one that makes your heart just flutter. They can't do anything about it.
I buy clothes quite frequently. I tend to do a lot of my shopping online. So I have orders come in at least once or twice a week. I actually have an order right now that I'm going to pick up. It's a new dress and I'm quite excited to wear it.
Excessive consumption is actually proven to make us feel, if not bad, it doesn't make us feel good. Recent research has shown that when we have too many things, we are constantly dissatisfied.
Let's say I spend about half my lunch break looking at clothes and then a little bit in between work tasks, and then you add that to some time when I get home and then the actual purchasing. I would say maybe like 3 hours a day is spent looking at websites, looking at baskets, returning things. Yeah, it takes up quite a lot of my time.
Extract 3.
Before the 16th, 17th century, many cultures thought of things as opposed to the self or the soul. And what we see in the modern period is a reversal. It is a cultural shift that things start to be seen as central to our identity.
There's something really interesting happening, actually, with consumers. People are actually beginning to get fed up with stuff.
We spoke to three generations of grandmothers, mothers and daughters. For the grandmother generation in that post-war era, there was a much greater emphasis placed upon being frugal. The mother's generation, they wanted to be modern and embrace technologies like the freezer and the microwave. The daughters rejected a lot of that. They saw themselves as being experimental, buying different ethnic foods, trying different styles of cooking, buying organic produce, ethical products. What we found was that these generations of women were all the same in wanting to be different, and the way in which they did that was through how they shopped and bought and used stuff.
Extract 4.
With the topic around climate change and the impact the fashion industry has on the climate, I am trying to be more mindful of my shopping. So I've recently made a rule to try and make sure that at least 50% of my wardrobe comes from vintage stores. And I really want to get to a point where I'm more mindful about it and it's less fast fashion and less vapid.
We've got so much stuff now, we don't really know what to do with it. We spend a lot of time trying to work out how to get rid of the stuff that we've got. Now, rationally, we might say, well, maybe we should stop buying all of this stuff, but we don't do that. What we do is retreat back into our imaginations and into our fantasies, and so we start the cycle all over again.
I would say, yes, I do have a mild problem when it comes to shopping. But I like to think that I could stop if I wanted to. Oh my God, that's exactly what an addict says, isn't it?
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract zero.
I have an entire operation around shopping. I take it very, very seriously.
I've got loads of items I just never even wear. Beautiful, beautiful quality. I've had it for over a year. It hasn't even been taken off the hanger.
Extract one.
When we look around the high street and stores, we see lots and lots of stuff. But the most interesting thing about consumption and buying is what's going on in our minds. The story of stuff begins in our imagination and in our fantasies. That's the space where we dream about all the things that we would really, really love to have and what a wonderful life we would have if only we could have this stuff.
I always think, yeah, this is it, this is the item. This is what's going to make me happy.
What we consume is an expression of our identity because our identity consists of a number of different facets. We have an actual self, who we actually are most of the time, but then we also have a social self. We buy products, clothes that express who we want to be at any point in time.
I have two moods, so, and they're both as vital to me as the other. Like, I feel like sometimes clothes help me take on a character.
Extract two.
Buying something new makes me feel excited and like full of adrenaline.
Marketers are very, very good at speaking to the parasympathetic nervous system, the one that makes your heart just flutter. They can't do anything about it.
I buy clothes quite frequently. I tend to do a lot of my shopping online. So I have orders come in at least once or twice a week. I actually have an order right now that I'm going to pick up. It's a new dress and I'm quite excited to wear it.
Excessive consumption is actually proven to make us feel, if not bad, it doesn't make us feel good. Recent research has shown that when we have too many things, we are constantly dissatisfied.
Let's say I spend about half my lunch break looking at clothes and then a little bit in between work tasks. And then you add that to some time when I get home and then the actual purchasing. I would say maybe like 3 hours a day is spent looking at websites, looking at baskets, returning things. Yeah, it takes up quite a lot of my time.
Extract three.
Before the 16th, 17th century, many cultures thought of things as opposed to the self or the soul. And what we see in the modern period is a reversal. It is a cultural shift that things start to be seen as central to our identity.
There's something really interesting happening actually with consumers. People are actually beginning to get fed up with stuff.
We spoke to three generations of grandmothers, mothers and daughters. For the grandmother generation in that post-war era, there was a much greater emphasis placed upon being frugal. The mother's generation, they wanted to be modern and embrace technologies like the freezer and the microwave. The daughters rejected a lot of that. They saw themselves as being experimental, buying different ethnic foods, trying different styles of cooking, buying organic produce, ethical products. What we found was that these generations of women were all the same in wanting to be different, and the way in which they did that was through how they shopped and bought and used stuff.
Extract 4.
With the topic around climate change and the impact the fashion industry has on the climate, I am trying to be more mindful of my shopping. So I've recently made a rule to try and make sure that at least 50% of my wardrobe comes from vintage stores. And I really want to get to a point where I'm more mindful about it and it's less fast fashion and less vapid.
We've got so much stuff now, we don't really know what to do with it. We spend a lot of time trying to work out how to get rid of the stuff that we've got. Now, rationally, we might say, well, maybe we should stop buying all of this stuff. But we don't do that. What we do is retreat back into our imaginations and into our fantasies. And so we start the cycle all over again.
I would say, yes, I do have a mild problem when it comes to shopping. But I like to think that I could stop if I wanted to. Oh my God, that's exactly what an addict says, isn't it?
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
We're going to listen and learn about how the cost of living has caused our modes of transport to go off track. Now, should I go somewhere with a famous transport system like Tokyo? Or somewhere with little to no transport at all? I always come back to the same thing. Where do the numbers take me? And what I really want the numbers to tell me is where in the world is one of the most expensive places for public transport. And that's when I settled in Auckland in New Zealand. Figures puts Auckland as the third most expensive city for public transport in the world. London and then my hometown, Dublin, placed first and second. But back to Auckland and to find out the reason why it's so expensive to get around there. I spoke to rail enthusiast and rail commuter John Reeves.
Auckland used to have an amazing tram system until the mid-50s, 1950s, when it was all ripped up and replaced with buses. And at that point in time, people decided not to take public transport and jumped into private motor vehicles. So we went on a huge motorway expansion project ever since the mid-1950s. So really, investment in public transport was pretty dismal, really until about the early 2000s. When our first underground railway station was opened and reopened at the bottom of downtown Auckland. And as soon as that happened, suddenly there was a resurgence in rail travel and a resurgence in interest in public transport. Now we have four railway lines in the city that are now used, and I helped get one reopened about 12 years ago. So now predominantly people use buses, but we still have ferries as well because we've got a large harbour and many islands which are connected to by a ferry service, and then we've got the rail network around the city. We could have quite a comprehensive public transport system, but as it is, it's not really that good compared to other cities I've visited and I've lived in.
To help with the cost of living, Auckland actually cut the price of its buses and trains and ferries in half.
Well, until recently, Auckland had one of the highest fares for public transport in the OECD, which has been terrible. And it all came down to sort of the neoliberal thinking of back in the early 1990s. When public transport services were tendered out and privatised, thinking that they could pay their own way. Well, it never really happened. And so now our services have been brought back under control of a city council, Auckland Transport, which still runs privatised services contracting to the city. However, the costs have been pretty high for users to use them, and it's been a limiting factor, especially for people in the lower socioeconomic backgrounds, where they wouldn't use public transport. Sometimes driving was cheaper. But now, of course, we've seen the cost of living crisis hit New Zealand like many other countries, and those people in medium and lower incomes are being hurt even using transport. So they are looking at public transport.
Germany did something really similar. Gregor Kolbe works on transport and consumer politics for the Federation of German Consumer Organizations. He lives in Berlin, and last summer, Germany actually made public transport much cheaper to encourage people to use it.
When I'm going to the city, I'm more or less all the time taking the buses, trains. I'm living probably 5 kilometers outside of the city of Berlin, and I'm very well connected to the public transport. So for me, it's the best choice. I have a monthly ticket for the public transport, and so it's most of the time the best choice for me. So in the summer of 2022, we had two initiatives by the German government, and one of them was the introduction of a so-called 9 euro ticket. This is a German-wide ticket for the public transport for 9 euro per month, which is very, very cheap. And you can use all local public transport, buses, trains throughout Germany. And this was a huge success. More than 50 million people bought this ticket in the 3 months where it was valid. And at the same time, we had the reduction of the energy tax on fuels as well. So that led to the situation that the fuel was around 30 to 35 cents cheaper than without this reduction. And it was, a measure to provide financial relief to consumers due to the high energy prices, which came up after the invasion of Russia to the Ukraine.
The idea is that initiatives like the ones in Germany or Auckland that reduce the cost of transport helps us because, at the end of the day, everything else is going up. The only problem is that Germany's big transport discount came to an end, and New Zealand's discounts will end in March. So prices will go back to what they were, and inflation is still riding high.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
We're going to listen and learn about how the cost of living has caused our modes of transport to go off track. Now, should I go somewhere with a famous transport system like Tokyo, or somewhere with little to no transport at all? I always come back to the same thing. Where do the numbers take me? And what I really want the numbers to tell me is where in the world is one of the most expensive places for public transport. And that's when I settled in Auckland in New Zealand. Figures puts Auckland as the third most expensive city for public transport in the world. London and then my hometown, Dublin, placed first and second. But back to Auckland and to find out the reason why it's so expensive to get around there. I spoke to rail enthusiast and rail commuter John Reeves.
Auckland used to have an amazing tram system until the mid-50s, 1950s, when it was all ripped up and replaced with buses. And at that point in time, people decided not to take public transport and jumped into private motor vehicles. So we went on a huge motorway expansion project ever since the mid-1950s. So really, investment in public transport was pretty dismal, really, until about the early 2000s. When our first underground railway station was opened and reopened at the bottom of downtown Auckland. And as soon as that happened, suddenly there was a resurgence in rail travel and a resurgence in interest in public transport. Now we have four railway lines in the city that are now used, and I helped get one reopened about 12 years ago. So now predominantly people use buses, but we still have ferries as well because we've got a large harbour and many islands which are connected to by a ferry service, and then we've got the rail network around the city. We could have quite a comprehensive public transport system, but as it is, it's not really that good compared to other cities I've visited and I've lived in.
To help with the cost of living, Auckland actually cut the price of its buses and trains and ferries in half.
Well, until recently, Auckland had one of the highest fares for public transport in the OECD, which has been terrible. And it all came down to sort of the neoliberal thinking of back in the early 1990s. When public transport services were tendered out and privatised, thinking that they could pay their own way. Well, it never really happened. And so now our services have been brought back under control of a city council, Auckland Transport, which still runs privatised services contracting to the city. However, the costs have been pretty high for users to use them, and it's been a limiting factor, especially for people in the lower socioeconomic backgrounds, where they wouldn't use public transport. Sometimes driving was cheaper. But now, of course, we've seen the cost of living crisis hit New Zealand like many other countries, and those people in medium and lower incomes are being hurt even using transport. So they are looking at public transport.
Germany did something really similar. Gregor Kolbe works on transport and consumer politics for the Federation of German Consumer Organizations. He lives in Berlin, and last summer, Germany actually made public transport much cheaper to encourage people to use it.
When I'm going to the city, I'm more or less all the time taking the buses, trains. I'm living probably 5 kilometers outside of the city of Berlin, and I'm very well connected to the public transport. So for me, it's the best choice. I have a monthly ticket for the public transport, and so it's most of the time the best choice for me. So in the summer of 2022, we had two initiatives by the German government, and one of them was the introduction of a so-called 9 euro ticket. This is a German-wide ticket for the public transport for 9 euro per month, which is very, very cheap. And you can use all local public transport, buses, trains throughout Germany. And this was a huge success. More than 50 million people bought this ticket in the 3 months where it was valid. And at the same time, we had the reduction of the energy tax on fuels as well. So that led to the situation that the fuel was around 30 to 35 cents cheaper than without this reduction. And it was, a measure to provide financial relief to consumers due to the high energy prices, which came up after the invasion of Russia to the Ukraine.
The idea is that initiatives like the ones in Germany or Auckland that reduce the cost of transport helps us because, at the end of the day, everything else is going up. The only problem is that Germany's big transport discount came to an end, and New Zealand's discounts will end in March. So prices will go back to what they were, and inflation is still riding high.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.